I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events, major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories, the unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome to a Wednesday morning. It's Dake and Sandra. Thanks so much for being with us. We've got a couple of hours of fun and frivolity. Great guest coming in 10 o'clock. He's Dave Wilkinson, president of the Atlanta Police Foundation. A lot of folks geeking out on that show, American Manhunt, a hunt for Osama bin Laden. He's been in here before. He's Secret Service in the White House. He was on Air Force One that infamous day when President Bush was flying all over the country. They were trying to figure out where to go, what to do, and his stories were unbelievable. But he's got a slew of stories. He's fascinating. What it's like to be a Secret Service agent and be the top dog and hire all those folks, and a lot going on with the Atlanta Police Foundation. Anyway, he's in here. I'm going to ask him about the bin Laden stuff because that show's trending huge on Netflix as well. So he'll be in the 10 o'clock hour, but we got a lot to get to prior to that.
I would like to introduce something to the listener, if we may peel back the onion just a bit. Yeah. So my teammate, co-host, appears this morning in what looks to be a golf outfit. Yes. Now, what does that mean? That is a golf shirt. That is golf shorts. That is, he's game on. So then
I got my Lululemon golf shirt and a pair of shorts. Mm-hmm. Just, I don't have my cap, my dog cap, but I'll have my Georgia cap ready to go.
Okay, so then you proceed to tell me.
Yeah, I'm in training right now. I'm in training.
So he is not a golfer, ladies and gentlemen. And self-proclaimed, you're not a great golfer. When people invite you, you're like, you don't want me on the foursome. I'm going to ruin the day, right? But the new stake is you're training to do what?
Well, we're going on this big guy's trip. I had a very, very close friend. I think you know him. Who had a life-changing event financially, sold his business for a lot of money. And I was like, bro, we had to do something to celebrate. I'm going to spend your money. Same guy made him throw the Super Bowl parties.
Yes.
My buddy Brandon. And he's getting into golf. And I was like, we need to go to Sea Island. Everybody says Sea Island's sick. The cloisters, the golf courses there, the cottages, the food. It's a very bougie, swanky place. I've never been. But everybody's like, if you want to spend somebody else's money, that's
where you go.
That's where you go. So I'm spending his money. There's a guy's trip, you know, the whole deal with the, you know, private everything. And I was like, if I'm going to play these golf courses at Sea Island, I don't want to suck. So I'm in training this month to get myself more respectable. Mm-hmm. So I have to play a certain amount. Mm-hmm. I have to play a certain amount of rounds of golf. I'm in training.
Now, by training, are we taking lessons? Are we going to a PGA Superstore and we got a golf pro showing us the ropes?
No, I was at the Bobby Jones Golf Academy where they were videoing me and
they
I was going to watch myself.
Okay, all right.
Now, I know you like to eat a sandwich or seven on camera, but that's what I'd like to see. Yeah. Don't you think that would be an amazing series?
100%, we need this. We need video of this.
You've got to be like, I'm going to learn to play golf. And not only that, it will challenge you to even be more accountable because you're like, no, I'm not missing. I've got to go get better, which I
just
love
wish,
that.
You know, my dad was the greatest dad. You knew my dad well. Mm-hmm. I just wish he, like, certain things, he grew up, like, if I was living down here, there's no chance I wouldn't have been playing golf.
Right.
You know, or boating or doing all the things. Like, you grow up in, like.
But you could host a Jewish film festival for exactly all shows that are four and a half hours and longer. You've got that gift.
I've been to more Broadway theater, right? No, I'm not. It's just like.
That's also a skill set.
It's how you're brought up. Yeah. It's how you're brought up.
I just think that's so relatable to guys because I know so many guys are like, I don't want to look at that golf course because I'm not good at it. Yeah. So they just want to poo-poo it and go, I'm never going to do it.
I hate being the worst at something.
Yes.
Right?
That's all men. That's all people, kind of, you know, if you're not good at it.
So I just played recently and I played well.
Okay.
And that's because of this Bobby Jones Academy where they video. And then I've been watching my videos. I've been analyzing. I'm trying to figure out. And then, you know, trying to get in the right mindset. It's not a good golf day today.
No.
I'm going out to the Standard Club. Our old buddy, can I say that? Scott Marr, who was our buddy from Barnsley from years and years ago, giving him a shout out. He was nice enough to invite us out. So that's where I'm headed today. I'm headed to the Standard Club. And
so is the, and I'm asking because I don't golf, is it just if you go play, you will get better?
Yeah, I mean, ideally, and take lessons and, you know, continue to play. And I was at the driving range the other day. So, yes, I'm trying to, also doing business as I'm trying to grow my business. You know, these when you're hanging out with like a lot of CEO types, or whatever, they want to talk about golf, that they're obsessed with it.
Right.
Like they have no time in the day.
And you're like, but did you see this cheeseburger that I was like,
they are obsessed with my videos. Dude, you'd be surprised.
No, I'm not. I totally get it.
I told you
that
place.
I totally get it.
That place I went in Sandy Springs, 01 Pizzeria.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That thing is blown up. I was there the other day. It's like 40,000 views already because there's like a 2-hour wait at this place. Anyway, so
well,
yes.
I'm intrigued.
I'm in training.
Callers, call in with golf tips or that you've done this and good luck, 404-726-0929.
Right.
Because I'm fascinated by you and I'm really proud for you. And John Gordon, by the way, this author who is amazing, he is going to come spend 2 hours with Steak and I believe it's July 11th. He wrote this book called The Energy Bus. And in it is an entire chapter on, wait for it, the men's brain and golf. That you will go 16 holes, you suck, you are terrible, you will claim you're never going to go again. On the 17th hole, you have a good shot.
Yeah, you have a birdie, you hit a big
and
putt.
You don't remember the other 16, and you're like, let's book
what
another
do you think
18.
Vegas, what do you think Vegas and sports gambling is built on,
sure,
right?
Sure, sure.
Having a hot roll at the craps table and remembering you and your buddies for 41
But it's a
minutes.
Man thing. He clearly makes a distinction on how our brains are wired. We females, we're just different, good, bad, or indifferent. But I'm so fascinated with men because that is true with y'all. And gambling is your craps run, man. If you get on a craps run, it's the same high.
Well, if you have like four straight trips to the casino, you get killed. But on that fifth one, you have that moment.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, that's all I need. Those endorphins, the dopamine of playing golf with your buddies outside, hitting good shots, competing. You're in a, you know, rider club type competition. You're playing best ball, whatever it is. Like, dude, that's addictive.
It's
These
a
guys,
real thing.
Yeah. So anyways, I think it'll be a quality of life thing for me as well. So
I'm proud for
that's
you.
That's what's happening.
Yeah.
We got a lot of stuff to get to. Do you want to play a sound you need to hear?
Y'all, this is really, really funny. Yes. So a little sound we need to hear first
Sandra's
and foremost.
Sound you need to hear. And by the way,
when I get excited in the afternoon when I'm just watching TV and Rusty starts sending me sound from the SEC meetings, and I'm like, oh my God, this is pay dirt. This is so good. And it's so awkward. SEC spring meetings, if you've ever been to Destin, the big Sandestin Hilton, that's where the meetings are. So they Paul Feinbaum's show is set up. It's a gorgeous shot facing the water.
On the ocean.
So they just keep schlepping with these coaches one by one and one by one. Kirby sits down, does a whole thing. Kirby's getting up, and Lane Kiffin sits down with Paul Feinbaum. And this is how the whole thing started.
Plus, I'm sticking up for Kirby. I just saw him walking off, and he said you were mean to him today. Guy's only been to, I just counted when they had him listed up there, 7 of the 8 last SEC championships, and you rip on him today.
I wasn't ripping on him. I was ripping on his quarterback.
Oh, okay.
I was just
telling you, he seemed in a bad mood. You used to piss off Coach Saban. Now you piss off Coach Smart. It's like you just move them around.
Listen, he also called for Lane Kiffin's head numerous times.
Mm-hmm.
He says he helped Lane Kiffin get fired. From previous gigs,
USC,
and they have this ongoing poke
the
banter.
Bear. Oh my God, it's so good.
Lane's like you were mean to Kirby. They're very tight, Kirby and Lane, and he's like how could you possibly be mean to Kirby? And you'll hear later on he dogs out Gunnar Stockton, and Kirby calls him out on that.
It's on live TV, you guys. It is great, great stuff.
Pure
we really enjoyed it. It's
pure
so true.
Entertainment.
All right, quickly, the 9 at 9. We're trying to avoid the elephant in the room. The Braves have now lost 5 of 6. You're shut out last night in Philadelphia, 2-0. It wasn't Spencer Strider's fault. The Braves struck out 11 times. They left 10 on base, including a bases loaded situation in the fifth. The offense is missing in action.
Yeah, I hated that game last night. That was incredibly frustrating to watch on so many levels. You're waiting for some kind of offensive spark that is just not there. Bad at-bats across the board. from some of the guys you count on and some of the guys you can't count on. I talked about Michael Harris the other day. I think he is lost at the plate right now.
That ninth inning, three straight sliders, three straight swing and misses. It was awful, that strikeout. Matt Olson looked – it was just a bad night, you guys. And don't even bring up Spencer Strider, who all he did was go out and do 4 2/3 of one-hit ball. The one hit, unfortunately, was a game-scoring – a one-run scoring double. It's just he had four walks, much better outing for him.
I watched the whole post-game with him on Bally's. What was it? It's
FanDuel.
I watched the whole post-game interview, and he was in a pretty good state of mind. Yeah, he says that you can't give up the first run. I mean, he's finding a reason to beat up on himself. He says,
"Well, you can't walk people. That's what that was the issue."
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a great outing, but it was it was
much improved.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he's not the problem at all.
6:45 tonight. AJ Smith-Shawver and Zach Wheeler. Falcons OTA, which we'll get into heavily in the next segment. The headline's going to read: No Kirk Cousins, but Stake. I'm more concerned with who else was not there. Some guy by the name of Kyle Pitts.
I'm just tired of talking about Kyle Pitts.
I'm tired of talking about Kirk Cousins. I don't care about him. Kyle Pitts is at least going to be relevant or supposed to be relevant and important to our team this year. It really annoys me. Big Joe Patrick was there. He's going to come in next segment.
Smoking Joe.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, I did hate watch a little bit of the Knicks in between me hate watching my own team, the Braves. The Pacers are one win away from advancing to the championships, 130 to 121.
Yeah, I mean, they're just the better team. They've got depth. They got too many guys that they throw at you. And Tyrese Halliburton said, oh, am I really the most overrated player in the NBA, according to the players?
Well, 32-point triple-double.
He was awesome.
No turnovers, first time in the history of history is a triple-double.
The Hawks were really, really close to getting Pascal Siakam.
Mm-hmm.
Really close. If you remember back when that trade was made, boy, did they need him, because that guy is an absolute offensive terror. He's already won a title. He could win another one. Last night, I think he went north of 30 last night. So the Pacers are the best team in the East. That's how they've been playing the entire playoffs.
Minnesota, Oklahoma City tonight. Quickly, Atlanta United has Orlando FC tonight down at MBS. Our pregame five-stripe special will begin at 7 o'clock. And you guys, heads up, this news got buried late, I thought. The PGA announces for our East Lake, the FedEx Cup, no more start and stroke system. Everybody begins even. I think a lot of folks are going to be happy about that.
Yeah, that whole thing, you're starting
it drives me
10 strokes back, and if you get the 10... You know, you make up the 10 strokes, you win the cup. But I mean, it's a vakakta. You know,
it's a vakakta.
It was a vakakta system. Vakakta is Yiddish for jacked
stupid.
Up. Silly. We'll talk Falcons. Also Braves. Also Kirby. Also all kinds of stuff. Sports Radio 92.9. It's not a good sign that we've been waiting for Ronald Acuna to get back. And since he's been back, we are 1-3. Not his fault. He got another hit last night. He's had hit in every game back. It's also not a good sign that we've been waiting for Spencer Strider to get back. Since he's been back, he's 0-2 in the games he's started. We're 0-2, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, not his fault yesterday. But my point is, when you sit around and you say, woulda, coulda, shoulda, we'll be good if, it will all take care. Listen, we were really good when we won the World Series and we didn't have our best player. Like, sometimes it's just like you are what your record says you are. So what our record said we were is a team a little bit under 500, because that's where we've been most of the year. And then we allowed ourselves to say, well, Acuna comes back and Strider comes back, we're not that team anymore. But maybe we are that team. Maybe your record says who you are. Now, you're not losing 5 out of 6, bad, but you're not, just because Acuna and Strider are back, good, of like you're going to go on an 8-game winning streak. Like, Strider hasn't pitched in a long time. He's not just going to come out and start throwing complete games, 110 pitches or 8 innings, and that's just not going to happen. And, you know, Ronald can carry this team, but he's not just going to carry him immediately when he comes back and it's like, oh, it's that simple. Like, it's never that simple. What plagues the Braves is just not that simple. It's a lineup that suddenly seems a little stale. a lineup that just doesn't have a lot of punch, and it's frustrating, man.
Badassery seems to be missing on that team. And I don't know how to, and you guys, you Braves Twitter, you're with me on this. Like, what is wrong? We can't put our finger on it, but there's no, like, hissy fits in the dugout. And what you just struck out and you just walk off ho-hum. Like, I don't like that. By the way, Strider's line last night, 4 2/3, a hit, a run. He walked 4, struck out 7. He threw 90 pitches. So those of you that are freaking out if he's only going for, well, he threw 90. And the last two he faced, he walked. So it was time to go. 50 of those were strikes. So that was his line. You cannot strike out 11 times. You cannot leave 10 on base. And crucial, runners in scoring position is horrendous. And that's been the problem since our 0-7 start, you guys. Runners in scoring position, you can't get them
in. I need to see where we rank, because I just to contend every time we lose, somebody mentions it, and you don't mention it when we win. I don't think we're any better or worse than probably what our record says. You know, the reason you get shut out, the reason you score no runs is because you had a bad night with runners in scoring position. The reason you score 6 runs is you get clutch 2-out hits. I mean, that's just, you know, how this thing plays out. And, you know, you have guys that the lineup, it's not a feared lineup the way it was. Forget about just 2 years ago, but even last year. I don't know, you know, like strikeouts are just so common in the game. It's just such a different game. You're like, you know, Ozuna goes down last night with relative ease late in the game. It's frustrating. But Marcell Ozuna is not the problem, you know. I mean, at least he's hitting, you know, he's hitting out of the 3-hole. He's got 9 homers. You know he's going to strike out a ton. That's part of the world that we live in right now, right? And Michael Harris is not generating offense, and Matt Olson and Austin Riley are streaky, and it just doesn't all get fixed. And maybe this is who we are, a team that's going to hover around 500 until we go on a 9 out of 10. The Minnesota Twins, I think, won 13 or 14 in a row this year, right? The yes. Phillies just came off a 9-game winning streak. The Dodgers started the season undefeated for almost a week and a half. Like, you know, you have to go on one of these runs. And we haven't had it. And until we put it all together, we are not a serious baseball team. We're just not. As they say in Succession, I love you, you're my team, but you are not serious people. And that's what I feel about the Braves. We're not a serious contender until I see us rip off a 10-1 stretch where you go, oh, that's who we are supposed to be. Here's Spencer Strider last night back on the hill talking about his effort.
I hate to surrender the first run of the game at any time, but I felt like it was very preventable in that inning. You know, so just really walked into the opposite game plan we wanted to do. And yeah, that's on me. So that's just execution and slowing the game down and being able to make adjustments in the moment. But other than that, I thought that, you know, Murph was great. We were on the same page and, you know, a lot of, for me, a lot of improvement.
All right. So giving himself some credit, right? A lot of improvement, he's mm-hmm. saying there. You want to hear more of him or not? You want to
This is, y'all, if you're watching the first, and he hits Bryce Harper, and he was clearly shaken and stirred, he certainly did not mean to do that.
Certainly not trying to hit him. I thought in the moment, I just assumed he had a guard on and, you know, was just pissed that I hit him and then saw him in pain, and that was tough. So I'm definitely relieved that he's okay. And, I mean, he's one of the best players, you know, this century. So needs to be on the field. It's best for the game. And it's good for us. You know, it's good to compete against him.
X-rays were negative. They did announce that during the game. He was not wearing that elbow pad that they said he normally wears. So for whatever reason, CJ Mikowski said it perfectly. The baseball can find you if it needs to find a body part. So.
Yeah, runners in scoring position per game. And this isn't necessarily an accurate depiction of who's good and bad, because teams with more hits and better offenses are going to leave more people on base. But the least amount in the league are the Angels and Cleveland and the Giants. The most runners left on base are the Yankees, Cubs, Toronto, and Philly. We rank right in the middle at 18th in terms of ranking of guys left on base. And again, there's got to be a better statistic like what your average mm-hmm. of guys on base. But again, better offenses have more guys on base. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's I don't know where to go, and I don't really care to go any deeper than that. Let's talk about the Falcons. Smoking Joe Patrick is here. Is there a storyline over the last 2 days that is more compelling than another as we go through this?
More compelling than another. Yeah. Well, I guess it depends on who you are. I think the biggest one probably coming out of yesterday is the attendance. You know, who is there, who is not.
Right.
And, of course, you know, Kirk Cousins is one that gets a lot of attention. But Kyle Pitts, I think, was the one that I heard the most kind of consternation over. He was not there. Now, I do want to say, and I said this on the morning shift, you know, the club, these are purely voluntary workouts to the point, and this is bargained by the players in the CBA, that the clubs are not even allowed to ask why they're not there because it is so purely voluntary. So we won't know. There could be a very good reason why he's not there, but we won't know until we actually talk to Kyle. But Michael Penix did say that he's been throwing with him this offseason, that he looks really good. So that's good to hear. And I think that shows that he's just not totally, you know, out to lunch on the team right now.
I find, like Sandra said yesterday, the conversations on Kyle Pitts and Kirk Cousins are just tiresome.
Exhausting.
Totally.
It's just like, and that's going to be the beauty of the season, Joe, is like once we see some of these rookies, right, on the defensive side, or once we see Leonard Floyd, or once Bijan is like, oh, wow, he's having an all-time NFL year.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
he's going to break the – like, then we'll stop talking about it. But, like, we're stuck in an off-season where we have these narratives that we can't get away from,
mm-hmm,
and they're just boring. Like, Kyle Pitts has had a very mediocre 4 years. He was overdrafted as the fourth pick overall. He doesn't appear to love football or be great. It's not the quarterback's fault. It's his fault. But it doesn't mean he can't be better. But okay, like, it's not like, is he the worst pick of all time? No. Did he have a better rookie year under Matt Ryan? Yes. Is it fair, the criticism? Of course it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, like,
he's the worst pick at where he was picked.
Yeah.
So I'll put an asterisk there. Taking a tight end at fourth overall in the history of the NFL, for him to have panned out this way in year five is approaching.
Yeah, that's why he's a bust. I mean, you're a bust if you were the fourth pick. If he was the third pick of the second round,
right,
where would he be perceived as?
Yeah, I mean, and last year you could see Charlie Warner start to get more and more of a snap share to the point where he was listed as a starter for the team. They were actually listing 12 players as starters for the Falcons offense that included both Charlie Warner and Kyle Pitts.
I mean, you're in the building. Nobody's in love with what Kyle Pitts does day to day and his effort. I mean, that's just what it is. It's like exhausting. Let's get to like stories that are like compelling, you know? And I know it's not your fault.
It's May 28th.
Right.
Yeah, that's the things we talk about when the offseason has gone the way it did for the Falcons.
Yeah, we can't talk about our rookie first-rounders till they're like, actually, there's a...
They're not even getting involved right now
right,
with the play. Like, they're off on their own, kind of doing their own scrimmaging, the rookies and the reserve guys.
Yeah. So, we appreciate that you're there, and we know it's not you that's not compelling. You're the most compelling.
You're so compelling, Jim.
You're the most compelling. But storylines out of OTAs, you know... I think there's going to be a hell of a lot of great stories this year. I don't think Kyle Pitts will be one. And I don't think Kirk 100%. Cousins will be one. And I don't think we're going to mention Kirk Cousins' name once the season starts. Other than we get a good backup quarterback, right?
That's right. That's absolutely right.
And is Aaron Rodgers going to sign with Pittsburgh? Is that happening or not? Well, like, what
up? I don't know. That's an odd. I don't know what that situation is going on. But I would say with Kirk Cousins not around, you know, you never know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, I guess that'll take care of it. So anybody listen to him on Joe Rogan? I guess he did Rogan last week, a couple hours.
And if I never have to hear him speak ever again in my lifetime, I'm so great with that.
Hey, when we
I'll start doing ayahuasca if I never have to hear him.
You
promise? I'll do it right here in studio.
You got enough anxiety. I don't think we need you on ayahuasca. Maybe that would
help. Maybe it would help.
Yeah. Hey, we come back. Kirby Smart tells you the biggest problem, the biggest issue in college athletics when we come back. Sports Radio 92.9. Sports Radio 92.9 The Game, coming up at 10 o'clock. Friend of the show, Dave Wilkinson, is the president of the Atlanta Police Foundation, former Secret Service agent in the White House for, I don't know, close to a decade. He's just awesome on the radio. Sandra gets to meet him for the first time. Lots to talk about with him. I want to talk about that bat phone. 11:10 at night. Got a little buzz on. You had a couple of cocktails with the wife at dinner. You're going to work for a few hours, and you pick up the phone. You say, grilled cheese, tomato soup, hot fudge sundae, mushroom sausage pizza, beef stroganoff, omelet, and a chicken tenders. Will they bring all that to you?
What are you talking about?
Is it an unlimited?
So he's living in the White House.
No, he's not. I'm saying, can presidents have access to that kitchen at any time?
It's like, what is going on?
It's like having a Greek diner from New York City
downstairs. Oh my God!
Like, if you just get the hunkering at any time, are they ready to just like? And what are you doing if it's Secret Service? Are you eating? I know there's a cafeteria in the White House.
And where do they live? Is there a side wing or they're just?
Well, they're not living.
Is there
there
a room next to?
I don't think Secret Service lives in the White House. They live nearby. They have shifts. I saw that show Paradise. You guys seen that show?
No.
About the Secret Service dude in that place that may or may not be the world after a major disaster, and they built a whole world underneath the ground that you don't know about until the first episode, which I'm not giving that much away. There's 8 episodes. Anyways, I don't think that's true. I don't think there's an underground world that they built. But
I think if you're in that White House and you want something, you just go get it. You just call, like you just said, all of that, and they just bring it up.
Well, like trying to go to dinner when you're the president, like when you try to have date night, you know, that's a complicated thing. He'll tell us. He lived there with the Obamas. I think he lived there with the Clintons, I heard, or the Bushes. I don't know.
I think about the same thing when Travis Kelce and Taylor try to go to supper. Can you imagine what goes on? It's a lot of work. I wouldn't leave the house.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's hard to be normal in that scenario. Mm-hmm. Speaking of normal, it's anything but normal. The relationship now is TNT will have their final TNT broadcast possibly coming up in game. Were they last night? TNT, yeah. So game 5 in New York would be the final ever NBA on TNT in its current form, right? On TNT. But the relationship with ESPN is already fractured. Charles, more than Kenny and Shaq, has said, like, I don't know how many days they want me to work. I was not given any real choice about the relationship between TNT licensing the show to ESPN. Are you an ESPN employee or a TNT employee? TNT doesn't get the games. ESPN gets the games. The end of the relationship with NBA and Warner Discovery Channel, whatever. Well, last night, Charles was just irritated all the time now.
The Oklahoma City Thunder are going to win the championship, and anybody want to bet me any amount of money, come to my damn house because I can afford it. OKC is the best team in the NBA. I've been telling y'all that for 2 months. Hey, ESPN, I love you guys. Don't try to make Anthony Edwards the face of the NBA. The face of the NBA is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Joker, and Giannis. You can't give it to people. They have to take it. And Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is taking it.
Well, there you go. And he's being tongue-in-cheek when he says, I love y'all at ESPN, because he has been hammering them all the time.
Is there a chance that we never see those four in any sort of
There's too much money. They're not going to ask him to do a lot. They're licensing the show just the way they do McAfee.
Yeah.
Do you see Pat McAfee on SportsCenter? Do you see Pat McAfee on Around the Horn what's Stephen A. Smith's show? First take. Do you see him on there?
Negative.
No. He's going to do his show. And that's all they're going to do. Charles very occasionally would do maybe Kornheiser and Wilbon, right? He'd do that show. He may appear on Van Pelt, maybe. But Charles does the TNT show. And that's what he'll do. And it'll be out of TNT Studios. And it'll be licensed by ESPN, and I think it'll have the same kind of format that McAfee does. You work at ESPN, but you're really not part of that whole, whole deal. So,
fair enough.
I'm looking forward to the documentary about Inside the NBA, which I guess they said is going to air after the final, during the final week. I'll get you more info. They did a whole behind the scenes for the history of that show.
I wonder who's producing that thing. We should get them in.
I know.
That's incredible.
That's a great point. We should have them in.
Yes.
Or just in general, as soon as the season ends, one of those producers over there. All right, we got a lot of college football to get to. Dave Wilkinson is going to be joining us in the 10 o'clock hour, so that's going to be fascinating. But they are in Sandestin, and the SEC coaches are parading about off the beach. and Paul Feinbaum and them are engaging in all kinds of stuff, but Kirby was front and center yesterday.
It's much ado about nothing, and that's the truth, because it's not up to the SEC, but the SEC, Sankey, and all the coaches and ADs are absolutely having conversations about the playoff format. And the takeaway from yesterday, just real quick, is this 5-11 model. Now, what does that mean? That means 16 teams, obviously. I don't have to show my work with the math. Five highest-ranked conference teams, and that's your four biggies and the group of five or group of whatever you're going to call
the
it.
The highest-ranked group of five team. The biggest group of five league winner that's ranked the highest gets a shot. Last year it was Boise State.
And then 11 at-large. And by the way, I love this. So everybody, you know what you should. That's it. And if the SEC has an additional six, then so be it. If the ACC has four, so be it. I like it. More to come on this. Obviously, it's up to Notre Dame as a single entity. It is so crazy. This whole, they have to decide at those stake by December the 1st of this year, y'all. So that's kind of the date we have circled.
I would argue that the 4-2-2, what is it?
4-4-2-2-1.
4-4-2-2-1. That you'll probably get very close to the exact same as doing 5 and 11 at large. I think it would be very close. The only hook may be that the Big Ten gets a fourth team in the 4-4-2-2-1, that maybe the Big Ten won't always get four teams in. The SEC, I won't even worry. I mean, we're going to always get more than four, right? The question is, why does the Big Ten get that love and the ACC does not? Now, if the ACC can push forward and Miami, for the love of God, or Florida State, or Clemson, or if it's Belichick in Carolina, or let's hope it's Georgia Tech and everything happening over there, that, you know, that is an area with your system where they're not penalized and looking at the Big Ten and going, why do they get four and we
100%.
Get two?
I just don't think you should lock in a certain amount for any conference. But 5 plus 11, 16, let's do it. Moving forward, Kirby Smart took the podium yesterday, and he literally started off by saying, all right, all this other stuff, that's fine. But this?
The biggest decision that has to be made in college football right now, by far, to me, how far is when is the portal window and is there one or two?
Okay, so he continues on, and this was a long and winding soundbite, but he brought up the fact that when that portal is open now with a two, it's part of their championship, okay? So literally they're trying to win a national title and get in the semis and all that, and they got to deal with this portal. He continues.
I want to develop my team. I think it's really important in football to have your team at whatever date in January, whatever we decide that is. And then you work those guys out, you train those guys, you lift, you prepare, you do meetings, you do all this preparation, and then that's your team, right? Like, that's your team. And I'm great with the money they make. I'm great with them being able to go in the portal. And if you ask kids when they would like to be able to go in the portal, they're going to say in January so they can go get started where? At their new place.
God, it almost sounds like common sense, y'all, right? So if I'm – whatever committee decides to meet in the Holiday Inn Express and figure this out, stake, there should be a couple of people in that room, one of which is Rusty Mansell and any other recruiting expert that you care to find, because you know who knows it better than anybody? Rusty Mansell, and proves it with this one single tweet yesterday afternoon. Have one portal window opening for 10 days, January 3rd through the 13th. 95% of teams are done. All you have to do is declare that you're in that portal during that window. You can take longer visits to make decisions. Teams in the Natty have 5 extra days after that game. Sign it and be done with it.
Yeah.
Sign it and be done with it.
Did you hear the quote when Kirby said they don't want you crying from yachts? What did they say?
That's exactly. He said he has gone to them and said, don't need this in our championship time window. And he's like, we don't want people crying from their yachts.
Yeah.
Meaning
that you're in the national title game, boo-hoo, that messes up your portal, or that you have to do everything at once. Same time the portal's open, playing, you're getting ready for a playoff game, which is difficult and not fair. And then his response was, I know, don't cry from your yacht is
what
they're saying.
They patted him on his head and said, go away, basically. Yeah, but I just think it's fascinating to watch. And Rusty, I couldn't agree with you more. Now, the fun part of the program. Paul Feinbaum, it's in their contract that they have to go on SEC Network. I should say that. I'm assuming. I shouldn't say that. But I'm it's pretty much decided you have to go on Paul Feinbaum's show.
I just think they go on Feinbaum because it's good for the program. Right. I don't know if
okay, so Feinbaum, earlier in the day, before Kirby is even near, earlier in the day, they do a segment during one of their 800 sports centers, fine or not fine.
Fine or not fine with Gunnar Stockton, now their starting quarterback.
Fine. I know the team coalesced around him after the SEC championship game, but I was underwhelmed by what I saw from Gunnar Stockton in the Sugar Bowl loss to Notre Dame.
Okay, so then Kirby comes on live, y'all, and it's all giggly at Kirby. Clearly says, I heard what you said earlier, and then it gets weird, and then Kirby continues.
Yeah, I'm excited. Gunnar got the message, man. He got the message. You did your job.
Okay. Listen, I have admired you and respected you for so many years.
Absolutely.
I feel like at this point in your career, you need a little help from me.
I appreciate
it. To get
that.
You to the first game and over the finish line.
I'm glad you did. You've always been, that's why I always come on your show, because I love the fact that you give me that motivation.
I think Kirby's fine with Feinbaum. I would have thought it would bother him what he said about Mike Bobo, because that was so hurtful of one of Kirby's closest friends. I could find any guy on Peachtree to be a better coordinator than Bobo, which is such a lazy, you know, half-assed way to go about your job if you're Feinbaum. And I figured that was over the line, right? Because that really, you know, people listen to Feinbaum. He has the audience. But I think Kirby knows he is a necessary evil. He does not take that stuff so seriously. And I think that they all like the banter with Feinbaum because they know that's just part of the deal, right?
I think you're right. I think two things can be true, that they don't like him and that they're going to go on there and make the best of their situation, because if he goes on there and looks like a big fat jerk.
Listen, Saban didn't like him, or Saban was really irritated.
Oh, yeah.
Kirby doesn't let himself get irritated.
Yeah, right.
He's just above it. He just has a way about him, Kirby. It's like talking to any dad that's ever been recruited, and I've been lucky enough to talk to some dads, and Kirby recruits them, and they're like, there was Urban Meyer, there was Nick Saban, and there was Kirby Smart. And one of them my kids could completely relate to as just – a lot more normal, or could talk to you. And those other two were just like so much, you know, so much nonsense about, you know, uptight and anxious, and here's how we run our program. I think Kirby gets on Feinbaum. It's like, dude, I can handle him. Like, right. Whatever. I'm not going to get stressed out about it.
Which is why Lane Kiffin and Paul Feinbaum, and it's about 13 minutes long of this banter back and forth and back and forth. And here's just a little a segment that went later in Lane's deal.
Are we on the air?
I didn't know we were filming.
Oh, well. Well, we're out of time.
That'd be good for something.
It nothing has changed with Lane Kiffin. It's always like some of the most awkward TV in America, but I love it.
I think it's smooth.
Thank you, Coach.
Yeah. It's better than those cookie-cutter interviews.
It is.
You know?
How's your new quarterback going to be this year, Coach?
Hey, how's your third-string safety, you know?
He and Feinbaum, and he went right at him. I mean, I totally enjoyed it. And I think, first of all, Kirby and Lane are tight, right? But I don't know that I think Stake is right. Like, they just kind of – they don't have to like him, but it's part of the process.
I don't think Lane Kiffin likes Paul Feinbaum, because Paul Feinbaum, he says, helped get him fired at USC, right?
Mm-hmm.
And said awful things about him and crushed him numerous times.
Y'all, I'm going to tweet this whole article out.
I also think
so
if
good.
You're the head coach at an SEC team, he has too big an audience to say no to. Like,
yeah.
You don't win by saying, I won't go on Feinbaum's show. So, you know, he's not my, you know, cup of tea in terms of a broadcaster, journalist.
Journalist!
But he's got the juice, no question. Dave Wilkinson, we talk about life in and out of the White House. That fascinating Osama bin Laden show as well. It's all coming up on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. Steak and
Hey, this is Richard Deitch, the host of the Sports Media Podcast. If you're interested in what's happening with all the places where you consume sports, the Sports Media Podcast has you covered.
I've been turning down interviews all week. Hoda Kotb reached out, Oprah, George Stephanopoulos. So I said no. I was booked on the Deitch Podcast before the Taylor Swift phenomenon. I must live up to my responsibility.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Sandra. Thanks for being with us. Dave Wilkinson, who is the president of the Atlanta Police Foundation. Is that the right title, sir?
Yes, that is correct.
All right. You've been here once before. I want you to meet Sandy because last time you here is one of my favorite hours you've ever done. Those of you who don't know Dave, he's a history in law enforcement, Secret Service, and he was part of a documentary, if you haven't seen it. What's the name? Is it Air Force One 9/11?
It was called 9/11 Inside Air Force One.
Yeah. It was the absolutely riveting documentary of the day you spent with President Bush on the day of 9/11, what was going on that plane, the very few people that had access to, you know, the information that was there with you, yourself and Ari Fleischer and the president and three or four other people back there, right?
That's correct.
And just an awesome documentary that I got to watch and was kind of the hook to be able to get you in here. But I could talk about that all the way. But there is another fascinating documentary. It's three parts. It's on Netflix. It's trending huge as one or two viewed. It's called American Manhunt, The Hunt for Osama Bin Laden. I thought there's nobody that could, you know, understand this better than you. And I do want to talk about, yes, whether you can order a cheeseburger in the White House at 2 a.m, but that's important also. But have you seen the special?
Yes, I have.
What'd you think of it?
Well, I thought it was great. First of all, good morning, Sandra Steak, and
so
thanks
nice
for having
to meet
me
you.
On. You too.
Thank you for all you do and have done.
Yeah, well, my pleasure. And yes, Steak, I did see the documentary. I was very interested, obviously, because I was with the president on 9/11, and I sort of lived all of that as the day unfold of 9/11 and the aftermath for the next couple of years there at the White House. I worked very closely, obviously, with the White House, the administration, the president, and, of course, the CIA. So I heard a lot of the daily briefings regarding the hunt for bin Laden. But, of course, I'd left the White House by the time they finally tracked him down many years later and actually arrested him. So I was – found him and executed him. Yeah. And but I was interested to really see how they really actually were able to find him, and I thought it was fascinating.
What surprised you about some of the stuff? It's obviously you know more than 99.999% of any other American about the hunt for bin Laden, but what jumped out at you as someone who's worked in that, you know, around it as much as you have?
Well, the thing that jumps out at me probably the most is the fact that he was living in a popular area, in a compound that stood out within the community, and as opposed to for many years, it was thought to believe that he was living in a cave. There was a lot of discussion, rumor, innuendo around the CIA that he was actually dead, because you can imagine they bombed the heck out of those caves for
right.
years and years and years.
What was that Tora Bora battle? That it was how many years earlier when they blew up the mountains there?
You know, I'm not exactly sure of the years now, but it. But again, they absolutely obliterated that area. And at one point, they knew him for a fact to be in that area, and they bombed it. So as you can imagine, we went several years not knowing if he was alive or dead, and most probably would have guessed he was dead. And then all of a sudden he popped up in some sort of promotion video basically proclaiming he was still alive and well and doing well. But I guess the thing that surprised me the most would be he could be living in a very busy sort of tourist area of Pakistan. It's sort of a more affluent area of Pakistan, living in a home that was bigger and better than everything else around it. And the fact that he could live in that area for that long without somebody in the area notifying
leaking
the authorities
it.
Or knowing he was there, leaking
yeah.
it there, was pretty
remarkable.
Yeah, it really was remarkable.
And what about they build the simulated house, right, for the training exercise for the Navy SEALs? Where did that – I'm not sure if you remember where they built that house. But then the training exercises to plan for – every possible scenario, which I guess you're used to in your line of work, you're always preparing for landing in the middle of the night by this house, multiple helicopters, but they trained for it for months in a fake house, right? Somewhere in
well, that's correct. And as you can imagine, the execution, any tactical plan always typically comes down to the training, right? And at the end of the day, you know, the more they can replicate the actual scenario and train on that scenario. Because you can imagine, It's incredibly important to train for every conceivable emergency and have a contingency for each of those emergencies. Because I can tell you from firsthand, in every emergency situation, it never goes to plan. One of the things that it did not describe in detail in the documentary, but the SEAL Team 6 leader, I've gotten to know him a little bit over time, that was leading that that attack on the compound, said that the first helicopter, when it crashed, it actually was an interesting scenario because the helicopter went down nose first. And if it had not been for the tail of the helicopter to be resting on the six-foot wall. Now, think about this. So picture a helicopter pitched down like this, you know, in a 45-degree angle off the wall. Everyone in the plane would have probably died, because what happened, that allowed the helicopter blades, obviously, to continue to spin and basically and eventually break off. But ultimately, if it had not landed in the way it had, the helicopter could have absolutely
that could have blown up
and killed everyone.
Yeah, and then you would have been down to one helicopter, and you would have had your fallen comrades next to you, right?
Yeah. The other the remarkable thing, Steak and Sandra, that I think about the documentary was the political courage, I think, from President Obama to go forward with this, because, you know, I've been in a lot of CIA briefings and nothing's ever for sure, right? I mean, they're basically saying this is a hunch. This is a better than a hunch, but there's a lot of research here. But at the end of the day, we're guessing that he is there. And imagine how differently that could have ended up. Imagine if for some reason that helicopter had crashed and 15, 20members
soldiers.
Of our U.S. Navy had died. And Obama, I mean, bin Laden had not been inside the compound.
Well, yeah, I think if Joe Biden did, they talk about the voting in the cabinet where Biden did not vote for them to go in. And in some cases, Rumsfeld didn't agree on stuff. Cheney didn't agree on stuff throughout. You saw, who was it? That was also involved in all the names.
Well, Hillary Clinton.
Condoleezza Rice, Hillary Clinton.
Yep.
It wasn't just on that. It was going to war in general. It's how quickly Bush wanted to go to war. It's folks saying, we can't be sure. This could be another Jimmy Carter going into Iran situation where you blew that one, right? It was not a overwhelming consensus on a lot of those questions throughout.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that, to me, was another big takeaway from the actual event, and that is that President Obama had the political courage to more or less put politics aside and take the risk to do what's right for the American people and go get this guy.
Yeah.
And it paid off.
And post 9/11, Bush wanted an immediate response. And I think it was Rumsfeld who said, wherever they were, I think they were at Camp David or somewhere. And he's like, that's what I want to hear. We're going in now, as opposed to, you know, clearer heads or not. But there's a lot of emotion in those rooms going on.
Well, President Bush believed that that the American people needed to see a strong response, right? I mean, this was the, you know, most devastating terrorist attack in our country's history, and something symbolic needed to be done in a big way. So I certainly understand the response, certainly understand why it was so popular. Obviously, and after, you know, looking back on it, some of it obviously was a little bit sloppy, but it always is in times of war. But at the end of the day, you could certainly understand President Bush's response. You can understand why the American people supported that response, and you certainly can understand and appreciate President Obama's decision to go into that compound in Pakistan, risking even that political, as I mentioned before, but also the relations with Pakistan. Because keep in mind, he knew that telling anyone in the Pakistani government was an absolutely non-starter. There was no way they could do that.
Right. So they're going in under the radar, right? Because otherwise they would have been shot at, right? Because he wouldn't have known what foreign, you know, what foreign substance was flying over their airways that wasn't registered, right? Because you weren't going to tell them. Dead of night.
Yeah, it was all about timing, right? I mean, you have a certain amount of time where even an undetected aircraft's going to be detected, right? And so you have a certain amount of time from that. I think it pointed out in the documentary, if it did, and I'll say now, that this house happened to be less than a quarter of a mile from their military
training base. Yeah.
Well, their university. It was from their West Point. And so you can imagine it's a very highly protected area. And so at the end of the day, you know, their, you know, fighter jets are going to scramble at a moment's notice when they have a bogey in their airspace and they're coming. And so you can imagine those helicopters are no match for an F-16, right? So at the end of the day, all of this was very, very risky.
Executed.
And they had to do it on a timing. They had to get it in. They had to get out. And it all worked flawlessly. And to your point, I think the training was a big part of that.
How different was President Bush's personality being around him pre-9/11 and post-9/11 as a member of the Secret Service and as close as you were?
Well, I don't know if it was different. I can tell you that I'm extremely proud of President Bush and, you know, his actions on the day of 9/11. I think the American people would all be extremely proud of our president, the effort, the work, the commitment, the dogged determination, everything about it. In the months and months after that, I saw even more of that
right.
resolve. I mean, he's, you know, President Bush is kind of a man's kind of man, basically punch me in the mouth, I'm going to punch you back kind of guy. You know, he really is that kind of guy. And at the end of the day, you know, he was not going to allow these people to get away with this for nothing, for no other reason, right? And so you saw that determination in President Bush, and he's a very competitive person, as you can imagine. But at the end of the day, I just kind of feel like he felt like we'd been punched in the mouth, and we're not going to be satisfied till we punch him back.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about living around and in the White House. How many years were you there?
Well, I spent 22 years in the Secret Service, and I had several stints at the White House. The typical assignment is about a four-year assignment. As you can imagine, the travel is so extensive that you typically don't want to spend more than about 4 years. But I got promoted a couple of times and ended up spending 9 years at the White House under President Bush 41, President Clinton, and President Bush 43.
We're going to talk about that when we come back. Dave Wilkinson, live in studio, Sports Radio, 92.9 The Game. Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. Our buddy Dave Wilkinson, the President of Atlanta Police Foundation, doing phenomenal work, and crime numbers are down all over Atlanta, and recruiting officers and building that training facility, which, again, you're welcome here anytime to talk about any of that stuff. But we do love the juicy stuff about Secret Service and your travels and the things you've been privy to that you can share, and, of course, tons of things that you cannot share or would not choose to. And I ask you about the special that's trending huge on Netflix, which is American Manhunt, Osama bin Laden. Robert O'Neill takes the shot. He's he kills Osama bin Laden, correct?
That's correct.
Let's get your mic, sorry. Right, go ahead.
The way I understand it, Stake, is that as the SEAL Team 6 execution team went through the door, basically you had the team leader leading the group, and Robert O'Neill was the number two guy. So he was basically the second guy in the line coming through the building.
And
he was one fired the shot.
Are you comfortable? What are the rules when you're no longer active or when you were privy to that kind of, operation? Because there's not a lot of Navy SEALs in this special. There's just him.
Yeah.
And many of them are blacked out when you show the photos. In other words, they want to know their identity. This guy is front and center. He's made a career out of being the person that killed Osama bin Laden. What are the rules? Are there going to be people uncomfortable that he's that visible?
Well, first of all, you understand we in the federal government are all governed by, you know, on how the documents and the information is classified. So if something is classified as top secret, which this certainly was, anybody in the government would be precluded from talking about it while they're on the job or after they leave the job. But at some point, the information is eventually declassified and then ultimately becomes free to talk about. Now, second issue is whether it's the right thing to do to talk about it. You know, when you think about the president, you know, I often say this, that having close proximity to the president obviously allows you to hear every argument, every discussion, every family issue, everything that's going on in their family. Imagine having somebody at your kitchen table listen to every argument you ever had with your spouse or every time you ever got on your kids about something. You've got to be able to trust that that individual will always keep that to themselves and simply do their job. Because if someone like myself were to come forward now and start telling secrets, if you will, about the president or things that I overheard the president say, that were unsavory in some way, then what that would do is it would cause the current president to look at the Secret Service agents that are protecting him and say, you know what, I'm not really sure I'm comfortable you guys being close to me, because I just heard Dave Wilkinson the other day on the radio talking about things George W. Bush said 10, 12, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And so at the end of the day, it's incredibly important for guys like me, retired Secret Service agents, and I think the CIA is the same way, to be very careful about what we talk about, because it affects the jobs of the guys that are doing the job right now.
What are the protocol, I would imagine, is to be, is it expressionless? Is it no matter what's happening in front of you, a personal moment, whether you're in one of the vehicles or in the kitchen or a living room? You know, you see these specials where they turn to the Secret Service and now you're engaging in conversation with the president and the family. What are the rules of engagement, even in being around the family?
Well, as you can imagine, when you're on the president's detail, you have different levels of relationship with the president. Obviously, if you're a rank and file brand new agent on the president's detail, for the most part, you're saying good morning, sir, and good night, sir. That's about it, right, as they walk by. Then you take it to the opposite extreme. If you're one of the detail leaders, one of the executives that run the president's detail, you're talking to the president every day, right, about something, where we're going next, what we're doing, what are we doing this. And as you can imagine, you become very close to the president, almost kind of like you would with a brother or a sister, in the way that you can even be in the same room without feeling like you have to talk the whole time. So, for example, President Bush spent a lot of times at his ranch in Crawford, Texas. You can imagine spending hours with the president out, either working on the ranch, fixing fences, things along those lines, you know, chainsawing down trees, things like that, or just simply fishing. So you're spending hours with him. You're having every type of conversation you can imagine about everything going on in the sports world, everything going on in their world. And so it's just incredibly important that you have that conversation and you obviously keep it right there.
Are you doing chores alongside him? Are you fishing alongside him? You're just there.
No, and that's another thing. It's sort of a rule of a Secret Service agent, of course, is that you've got to be very careful. You're not the president's friend. You're obviously there to protect him. You're not his helper. You're there to protect him.
Right.
The way that it would get a little bit between or sort of odd would be, let's just say, for example, the president's lifting a log and moving it, right? And now you're standing there, right? You almost, right? You can't just stand there and not help him move the log. So yeah, there would be a little bit of that, but very little bit of that. For the most part, we would typically say, our guys, you need to stay back away so you don't get involved in becoming helpers, and you basically can do your job as protecting the president. But you know, but it was something that we lived every day with President Clinton. I spent a lot of time on a golf course, as you can imagine, probably twice a week, out on a golf course, walking the golf course, things like that. And so again, he's constantly talking to you, asking questions, getting your viewpoints on certain things, like, hey, what do you think about gun control? What do you think about the fact somebody can buy an automatic weapon anywhere? You know, what's your thought?
So,
there's a lot of that going on.
You're walking a golf course with President Clinton, and he's playing a round of 18. And there's, you know, political issues that are manifesting itself every day. Now, he's asking you, you know where he leans politically, obviously. Is that really a time for you to engage in saying, I think gun control is too harsh, or we need to be more lenient, or I come from an NRA background? I mean, what is he really – does he want to hear your true opinion, or are you trying to how real is that engagement of that conversation?
Well, President Clinton, first of all, was a great conversationalist, right? He would love to have a debate and just talk about things like that. So he absolutely would.
Wants
he would
hear,
say,
yep.
What do you think about this? And here's what I think, and what do you think? And he was just a great conversationalist. And I think he truly and honestly did want to get everyone's opinion about these sort of things. And, you know, he respects Secret Service agents because I think he basically, well, I know he did, saw the Secret Service agents as very anti-political, very guys that are going to give you their honest opinion. They're going to do their job first. They're going to tell you what they think. Now, I'm not saying that an agent would typically, if you disagreed with the president, say, I think you're all wrong and you're all wet on this issue. Probably not. But generally speaking, Yes, I think he did. I actually want your opinion.
Were you there for the Monica Lewinsky scandal in the White House?
Well, yes and no. In other words, as it took place, yes, I was there, and I was what they called a shift leader, which would be a mid-level supervisor that supervised the day-to-day operations. So I was in charge of what happened at the White House every day, for example, when I was working that shift. And it was my shift of agents that was involved and was ultimately subpoenaed. Was the ones that obviously led her into the Oval Office and all of that. However, I had been promoted to go and run the Austin, Texas office of the Secret Service and left just before the actual scandal broke. So in other words, while it all took place, I was there. But during the investigation, I was gone to Austin, Texas.
How'd you feel about your agents being brought into that and having to be, you know— kind of at the firestorm of some of that, right?
Well, it's unfortunate, but you can understand that you're talking about the presidential detail, working the inner sanctum of the president within the Oval Office, within the West Wing of the White House. Before anyone gets to that point, they've had various levels of security. They've gone through all kinds of security checkpoints and that sort of thing. And so it's not the Secret Service agent's job at the door of the Oval Office.
Right, so he can't come in.
To decide who comes in or
right.
No, the agent can go anytime he wants, but it's not his job or her job to decide who goes in and out of the White House.
Right.
The White House secretary, the White House staff, the White House officials, they're the ones that make those decisions. In other words, everybody going through has already been credentialed. They've already been
clearance.
And so
she got clearance a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, that's why you see the special about it, is that she was given that level of clearance. Yeah. Right, which raised some eyebrows. Obviously, how did this lower level intern get this much access?
But not from the Secret Service, because again, every time
she
went in there, she was either escorted by the secretary or someone brought her in the room, and so that was everyday occurrence at the White House. Right now, somebody's ushering somebody into the Oval Office to see the president. Right, and then 5 minutes later, they're ushering somebody else in. So again, this would have been something our agents would have never known about, thought about even, you know, because, again, it's just another person. Yeah, it's not their job. That's right.
Yeah. I mean, regardless of what might have been taking place, it's not a judgment call.
Well, and she's not a threat, right? She's not a threat. So at the end of the day, if—
But you weren't in the White House post the scandal to feel the tension and see, and, you know, I mean, obviously it was a tangible— tense time to be around that president and his family.
Well, yes and no. If you remember the investigation and overall, this thing took about 2 years. And again, as I said, right when the investigation broke, I left to go run the Austin, Texas office, but then got promoted again to come back to the White House as the assistant special agent in charge of the president's detail under President Clinton, right as the investigation had just ended.
With Ken Starr.
And all that had ended. So I did get back to the White House right about that time. And so, yeah, and spent the last year and a half or so with President Clinton while he was in office.
That's a front row seat to real-life American domestic, you know, issues in your house, I guess, huh?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no question about that. And again, most of that I would certainly never talk about. But at the end of the day, I will tell you, your viewers, that most of what you read and hear that happens at the White House is exactly what happened. Meaning there's very rarely is there any other nuance, very rarely is there any kind of conspiracy going on. For the most part, it is exactly what you thought when you read it. And I remember always thinking of that when I was at the White House. There's very little that's not, front and center when you're at the White House.
All right, we'll talk more to Dave Wilkinson, lots more on the incredible special on Netflix and life at the White House, and maybe one of the worst Secret Service moments ever happening on this last campaign for Donald Trump, the President Trump. Sports Radio 92.9 The Game.
Fascinating.
Yeah, but it's, you know,
Hey, it's 10:42. Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. Dave Wilkinson runs the Atlanta Police Foundation.
Football is fun. Why shouldn't your football podcast be the same?
Follow and listen to Heed the Call NFL podcast with Dan Hansis and Mark Sessler wherever you get your podcasts.
Which basically helps fund Atlanta Police, helps keep Atlanta safe, works with officers, been part of building that training center. I was lucky enough to take a tour, which is just fascinating. What part of town was I in when I was taking that tour?
Well, that's east side of Atlanta. It's actually unincorporated DeKalb County, but it'd be on the southeast side of Atlanta.
Yeah, incredible facility that's well into being built out even more, but training on that space as well, and getting us ready for World Cup and making sure the World Cup undertaking, the security detail around major events. I think we talked about New Orleans last time you were here because we just had the horrible breach on Bourbon Street. But there's no joke in all these American cities, including Atlanta, get ready for World Cup with the whole world coming to America.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we've got the finest police chief in the country in Darren Sheerbaum.
Great guy.
And I just cannot tell your viewers what a great, great job and great leader he is for this city, and how incredibly lucky we are to have him here in this city. And, of course, they are obviously knee-deep in planning for the World Cup, the Super Bowl coming in a couple of years, all of those big events. They will do everything they can to train and plan for every conceivable emergency and to make sure they have a contingency for each of those emergencies.
When you see epic security breaches or lack of execution, like what happened on Bourbon Street for, I guess it was the Sugar Bowl, mm-hmm. or what happened with the assassination attempt on President Trump, what goes through your mind other than you said to earlier, it's never going to go as planned. You have to plan for the unexpected. But sometimes you must shake your head and say, boy, that can't happen in that manner.
Well, first of all, I think you could understand that every security plan can be defeated, right? In other words, there is no foolproof security plan. Every plan can be defeated. Every security plan is done with a measured approach, right? You have to put a security plan in place considering the cost to the taxpayer, considering, well, first of all, the impact of the plan, having the plan, the cost to the taxpayer, plus the inconvenience to the citizens. Most anything you do from a security standpoint is going to inconvenience people. So you have to use a measured approach. And so there's the real trick to security planning for major, large-scale events, is identifying what is that measured approach. How can you put a plan together that is going to be the best use to the tax dollars from the citizens of Atlanta? It's going to least inconvenience the public while at the same time making it safe. And so there's certainly some do's and don'ts about that. You have to study what's going on globally. You have to look at your, obviously, your intelligence information that's coming from city, county, state, local, federal sources. And you have to consider all of these. But as I said earlier, the most important thing is to game plan. Basically, you'll hear them doing tabletop exercises over the next year or two. And that is to take a look at every possible scenario and say, what are we going to do if this happens? And be planning for that. And there's certain things, to your point, Stake, like a car bomb. Obviously, we've gone too far down this road, right, not to be planning for every scenario involving a car bomb, allowing a vehicle to drive into a building. That obviously cannot happen. The next big thing I think that we've got to really focus on in planning in this country, and Atlanta is no exception, is and that is to plan for drones. The use for drones right now across this country is prolific. Obviously, the technology is growing at light speed. The capabilities of drones to carry things such as weapons is growing at light speed, and that is a big frontier that security is trying to tackle right
now.
Scary
stuff to hear. What about the notion that if we knew half of – if the American public was privy to half of the threats or, behind-the-scenes mayhem – then we'd be scared to death. I mean, how much credence do you put to that?
Well, you know, as you can imagine, in law enforcement, you take every threat seriously, of course. You assume every threat is real. But the challenge is kind of in your question, and that is, but having experience, knowing that 99% of the threats aren't real, you could have a natural tendency to dismiss some of these threats, and that's what you have to combat against, right? You have to investigate, review, and make sure you have thought through every one of these threats. Because to your point, I think your viewers would be, or your listeners would be surprised to see the level, the number of threats that actually get called in, whether it's bomb threats, whether it's threats against political officials, things along those lines. There's a lot of that. And so there's a lot of work being done by the intelligence services to discern whether these threats are real, whether they're actionable, whether they can really take place or not. Threats against the president happen every day in this country.
Right.
Right? And so it's really easy nowadays to pick up a phone, make a direct threat, to send an email threat, to put a threat out on social media, or just yell out a threat at a bar, right? And so all of that has to be investigated to the nth degree to make sure it's not real.
Now, we hear our country's on a terror alert over a big holiday weekend. What may it manifested itself to get to that point?
Well,
it's been years, but it was a more regular occurrence, I think, years ago, where you would hear America is on a terror alert and ask people to be vigilant this weekend. Airports are heightened and everything else.
Well, see, that's a challenge as well, right? Because if you start saying you're on a terror alert every other, you know, holiday, then people are going to get sort of numb to that as well. So a lot of it has to do with, again, I'm going to use the term again, intelligence gathering, right? You rely internationally on the CIA to gather that intelligence information about threats to our country, Homeland Security as well. And then domestically, you rely on the FBI for the most part. And then in the state of Georgia, you rely on the FBI and the GBI for the most part. And then locally on your Atlanta Police Department. So all of those agencies have their own threat assessment arms that are making a daily threat assessment of what the citizens of Atlanta or the citizens of this country have to be concerned about. And there's a lot that goes into that. But they're doing that every day and do the best they do to put the information out there to not scare people, to basically to make them realize there could be a threat out there and be the lookout. And the biggest reason they do it, Stake and Sandra, more than anything else, though, is to make sure that every viewer, listener, every disseminator of this information that gets this information can become the eyes and ears of law enforcement. And that's why Homeland Security puts out the old saying often that says, see something, say something. It really comes down to that, because the best investigators for law enforcement and intelligence gatherers for law enforcement are the citizens themselves by just calling and saying, hey, I saw something. It looked kind of funny.
You ever been starstruck by the world leaders that you might be in a room with, or that the stars that would come through the White House, or something where you would certainly maybe be able to tell your wife or buddies, like, dude, I was in a room with these three or four people, assuming that it's not on, you know, confidential, classified.
You know, I'm a sports guy, so I first of all, the answer is no. I mean, I've been around popes and, you know, every president in the world.
You're around
and,
Putin.
You know,
at one
Putin.
Point.
I've met Putin several times. I mean, so all these folks, and it's sort of the usual stuff at the White House. I'll give you a funny story. I'm sitting in my office one morning at 7 a.m., something like that, and the president hadn't got up yet, or he hasn't come downstairs yet, and so we're waiting for the president to come down, and I've got this little office in the West Wing, and all of a sudden the door bursts open, and it's Mick Jagger, and he says, hey, have you seen so-and-so? And he gives the name of a staff person. I said, no, she's not here, but who's escorting you? And he goes, well, she was, but I can't find her. And so I sent an agent out there to escort him back to where he was. And so who would have thought at 7 a.m. the door's going to rip open and Mick Jagger's asking me a question?
That's wild. What about the sports stuff you got a kick out of?
Well, I was going to say probably the closest I've ever gotten to your point of being a little starstruck is when I met Muhammad Ali the first time. And I was pretty impressed by that. I was a fairly young agent. And I just thought, you know, there was something about him that, I don't know, this may sound a little corny, but there was an aura around him. Aww. Like, it was like something I had not seen before.
What president was he engaging with? Do you remember at the time or what?
At the time, I guess it was President Clinton,
yeah.
And it was probably here for the Olympics, actually. Or we were coming down here for the Olympics. Yeah, that was probably when it took place. But all of these people are at the White House. You got to realize that when Tom Hanks comes out with a new movie, he previews it at the White House with the president. So we sit in a little room and watch the movie.
So take us back for a second. This is, so that's Obama, I would assume?
Well, that was Clinton.
Okay, Clinton.
And so I use that as an
example. So he invites him.
Correct.
For a screening.
Correct.
So it's Tom and Rita, maybe, show up.
Yep.
And then you're all in a side room watching the film?
There's a movie theater in the East Wing of the White House. And we would basically go in there. Of course, I stand in the back of the room, or the Secret Service supervisor stands in the back of the room. And there's, I don't know, maybe 10 seats, just like a home theater that somebody might have.
You got popcorn?
Definitely popcorn. And the president, because I used to kind of joke and wonder if the movie really sucks. Yeah. I mean, I wonder.
What's he going to say?
What does the president say, right?
Yeah.
But again, the who's who are coming through the White House, you know, every day.
You
can't turn around. As they say, you couldn't throw a rock without hitting a celebrity, right? And so it's not unusual. You're used to that. What I used to think was kind of interesting is we're used to being around the president so much. Obviously, you're not nervous around the president because you're with him every day. But to see the celebrities nervous around the president, that was always kind of interesting to watch this person, you know, maybe this super mega star, and you see them kind of stuttering and stumbling over their words when they're talking to the president. And you go, hey, man, this guy's just a guy like you are, you know.
Get used to it. I would imagine you get people that are so almost terrified of that, even on a celebrity. But how nervous do people get for that moment?
Oh, they absolutely do. And I tell you funny stories. Like one time I was in a crowd and I turned around and literally knocked Michael Jackson down, right? Oh. So as I turned around to say, excuse me, whoever I bumped into, it was him. You know, so I kind of half helped him, but he didn't fall down all the way, but kind of stumbled. And that's common in the White House, and to watch these folks. And, you know, after 9/11, Alan Jackson wrote the song, right, about 9/11. He came and previewed it at the White House. One of the first times he sang it, I guess, one of the first times he sang it to the president there in the East Room. Then when I think it was Toby Keith wrote a song and came and sang it right there in the East Room of the White House. So that's not a new story.
You've seen some good private shows, concerts, right?
Oh, unbelievable. Yeah, 100%. Right? Yeah. And not only there, I mean, if you think to just presidential events, I remember President Clinton, we were in Martha's Vineyard, and he went to Harvey Weinstein's wife's birthday party. And imagine going to a birthday party where, I don't know, there may have been 20 people there, right? It was just very small guest list. It was Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg and some people like that too, but only like 20 people. And they had two people singing, and one of them was Jimmy Buffett.
Yeah.
So he sang two songs. Now, who would imagine get Jimmy Buffett to come to your house and sing two songs? And the other one was Carly Simon.
Oh, wow.
So I'm thinking to myself, now that's
good
some power
when
you can get Carly Simon
yeah,
to come
just in your backyard
sing
there.
Two songs in your backyard.
Yeah. Right.
But no, you know, that was just the everyday life of a Secret Service.
Fascinating.
I'm sure the guys right now are seeing all that at Mar-a-Lago every day.
John Foy, thanks so much for your game of the night. It's Atlanta United, and Orlando FC is here at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Our coverage here, Five Stripes Network, is 7 o'clock. They start at 7:30. And thanks so much to the Wise Guys, ProWash.com, for sponsoring this hour. Dave, you're the wisest guy I've ever met, for sure. That was so amazing. That was amazing.
Always steak, interesting. As I said, you're always welcome here. A million other things we can chat about. Thanks to Dave Wilkinson. Support Atlanta Police every opportunity you get. I'll see you soon, I hope. Thank you, Bo. Thank you, Smoke and Joe, as well. And back tomorrow with Drew Butler on Sports Radio 92.9. See you, Dave. Thanks.
Thank you, guys.
From the trusted team behind 48 Hours, welcome to Case by Case, your weekly update on the biggest true crime stories unfolding right now.
Nick Reiner remains in custody without bail.
Luigi Mangione accused of stalking and gunning down United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson.
From high-profile trials and stunning evidence to major breaks in cold cases, we'll follow it all case by case. Follow and listen to 48 Hours Case by Case wherever you get your podcasts.